I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In April, England's High Court ruled that doctors could stop life support to a months-old child with a rare brain disorder so the child could die with dignity. But the parents want to bring him to America for experimental treatment. It raises the question, should parents' wishes come before a hospital's? Should every effort be made to save a life? Today, the ethics professors discuss that. I'll also ask about a predicament that some in the Trump administration might be mulling right about now, where a government official's duty to follow orders ends and where their obligation to the Constitution begins. That and a quandary of involuntary deboarding. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Loyalty. We value it, we preach it, but we also know that it can be abused. A possible case in point, President Trump's request for loyalty from former FBI Director James Comey. Today we'll talk about the ethics of loyalty with who else? The ethics professors, and we'll also talk about that difficult case involving Charlie Gard. He's the 9-year-old baby in England where the high court ruled in favor of the hospital treating the boy, saying life support should be removed and Charlie placed on palliative care. That even though the parents have raised the money to take him to a hospital in America for an experimental treatment. Question, should the parents' wishes take precedent in cases like this? Should every medical effort be made to save the life of a baby? Or are there limits? For tough questions like this, we turn to the ethics professors, and they are Wayne Vaught. He's the dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. He's also a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics. He's one of my bosses on campus. And Wayne, good to have you back.
Great to be here, Steve.
Clancy Martin is a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC and a professor of business ethics at the Block School of Management. Clancy, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
Well, let's start, Clancy, with the Charlie Gard case in England, where the High Court has ruled in favor of the hospital, saying that life support should be removed. The baby is suffering from a disease that causes this progressive muscle weakness and brain damage. This is a wrenching case, as these cases always are. How can anybody justify pulling the plug on a 9-month-old baby if the parents don't want it to happen?
Well, naturally, in this particular case, we do have an opportunity to respect the parents' wishes. And in general, when it comes to any sort of healthcare decision, the first thing we look at are what are the wishes of the patient. When the patient can't express his wishes, then we look to a proxy consent, we call it. And in this case, of course, it's the parents have the proxy consent.
But they're not getting what they want here.
No, and insofar as they are appealing to the UK system, of course, it is up to the administration of that, proper administration of that system, in this case, the court, to decide on the allocation of scarce resources. Now, when we teach end-of-life care in a course Wayne and I teach every year called Money, Medicine, and Morals, the toughest cases we come across are precisely these cases where an infant's life is at stake. And very often our students will say that when it comes to children, particularly infants, they don't care about the cost. Any number of resources should go towards this. But that would be realistic if we had unlimited resources. We do not have unlimited resources. So we do find ourselves frequently in the healthcare business having to make these kinds of tough decisions. Now, in this particular case, given that the parents have raised the money, they're no longer appealing to the system in the same way.
And they want to come over here.
Entirely within their rights to take their infant and bring to the United States and do whatever they like in terms of the healthcare, that as long as they're using their own resources and not the resources of the state. Now, it's a
separate. Is that going to happen, or do we know?
I don't think we know right now whether or not that is actually going to happen, but they are certainly within their rights to do that. And I can't imagine any argument which would say, no, you are not allowed to use those resources to save your own life or the life of your infant child, whatever it is that you're choosing to do.
I think it's still under appeal. in the court. So they're still going to be looking at the case and making a determination, I believe, probably in the next 2 or 3 days.
You know, Wayne Vaught, Clancy just used an interesting phrase, the allocation of scarce resources. Mm-hmm. I think when a lot of people in this country think of the healthcare system, they don't look at it in terms of scarce resources. They think of it as, I can get pretty much anything I need to take care of my particular situation. What's the scarce resources business all about?
Well, scarce resources tends to, and it applies to any healthcare system. The one that we're talking about now, where this child is being taken care of, is the National Health System in England. So it's a government-funded, single-payer provider healthcare program, which has limited numbers of dollars that come in to provide the resources and services that it provides, and therefore they have to make allocation decisions because there are more needs than there are resources and dollars to be spent and providers to provide that care.
How about in this country? Do we have the same kind of allocation going on?
In every country, we have allocation of resources, and there's always scarcity. It's just a matter of how those resources are allocated. Prior to the Affordable Care Act, largely it was on the ability to pay, and so resources were generally available for those who had the money to pay for them. But even in those cases, it's becoming increasingly more challenging. So if you now go to try to schedule an appointment with a physician, you're probably not going to get in there tomorrow, depending on what the specialty or whatever it is that you need, because providers, insurance companies, which are the primary payer for healthcare in the United States, still largely control the market, and they negotiate terms with those providers in terms of what they're going to provide care for.
That's problematic because insurance companies want to make a profit every year.
Well, insurance companies certainly want to make profits for their shareholders. Holders and do considerably well, but it is still a matter of trying to manage the resources that are available, and so costs get shifted onto the provider, onto the individuals, either through co-pays or the actual insurance premium. So most Americans with insurance don't see this unless they really pay close attention. So at UMKC, we pay 36% is about the benefits tax that we have for each employee, and a lot of that covers the health insurance. And so you don't see it in your wages, but it's certainly a part of the compensation package for an employee, and that continues to go up and up each year. So what you're paying for in the United States are, you have hospitals that are providing care. You Right. have individuals who need access to care. Sometimes they come into the system, and if they lack insurance, and certainly but prior to the Affordable Care Act, it'll be interesting to see how things change now, if there is some change. Those costs have to be paid out. And so the individuals who couldn't pay, those costs got shifted onto those with insurance and negotiations that you have with insurance companies, which in part explains why, I just went to the emergency room, had a kidney stone a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
A few weeks ago. Thank you.
That's not good.
Incredibly painful.
Yes, that's what I'm told.
I got some pain relief, got an x-ray to tell me how much it was, got a $10,000 bill from the hospital. Now, I'm not going to pay anywhere near that, but it shows that would be the cost of some uninsured person going into the hospital and getting the same treatment. You would get a $10,000 bill for a couple of hours in the hospital to get care for that treatment. And so what we have to decide, well, what types of things are we going to cover and what types of things are we not? And for an infant like the one we're talking about in England, you're talking about probably $10,000 or more per day of care for each day that child is in the hospital.
So that's what that system in England is up against, having to decide, is that amount of money worth it when we have so many other kids who also need help?
So millions of dollars, the family can't afford it. The insurance company or the National Health Service in this case, they're paying the cost of the care. They're paying for the providers who are providing the care, the technology, and all of these things. And so that has to be shifted out to the taxes ultimately that will come in to fund the National Health Service, but it will also restrict resources that could be available for other things, less expensive things, preventative care types of things, or prenatal care, and a lot of the things that we need to ensure that people have to maintain sort of an adequate quality of life. And this becomes the fundamental question that I think Clancy was raising, is it's the allocation of scarce medical resources. What we don't like to do in the United States is make these types of decisions. Well,
we don't even talk about it very much.
Oh, we don't. We don't, absolutely.
And, we steer away from it like it's some sort of pox on our house or something.
Right. And it's the reason that we have pointed to the Canada or the UK or most of the other countries in the world that do have a single-payer system, where these types of decisions have to be made and are, as you can see with this case, are being made. We can't provide the care for this 9-month-old child.
And I guarantee you, Steve, the next time we're having a conversation about the possibility of a single-payer system in American politics, there will be portions of the electorate who are opposed to a single-payer system who will gravitate to this case and say, in England, they weren't even going to provide care for little babies. Because, you will recall, anytime we have this healthcare debate in our country, we start talking about death panels, and all these kind of gloomy specters are raised by people who are opposed to single payer.
When in fact, and to some degree, it's already happening.
It's very much already happening. It's at some level, you might even say it's happening more in the United States than it is in countries with single payer systems. It's just that it's all happening without appropriate supervision, without appropriate decision-making processes. Letting money make the decisions rather than making the decisions ourselves.
I was going to say, what is the standard that gets used in situations like this? I mean, who decides and who guides doctors and families and hospitals on a daily basis at St. Luke's or KU Med or at any hospital around here when these decisions come up, Clancy?
Well, I should defer to Wayne because Wayne is an expert on this topic. Right. But
just to pin there, there are lots of studies that physicians will use that will determine what the life expectancy is after the first day of life, second day of life, especially given certain disorders.
So there are charts.
Absolutely. Yeah. There are charts in which you can make a relatively safe determination, and I'm sure that they have in this case that given the congenital defects that this child has experienced and the life expectancy based on where he would be is such and such, and the likely outcome is such and such, that they're making informed decisions about whether this is in the interest of the national health system, in the interest of the people that they are providing services for. Is this the best decision and the best use of dollars? And they're obviously making a determination that in this case, it's not in either the child's. And so one of the things that you would have to look at is what's the outcome for the child and the prospect for a relatively normal life or a pain-free life? Is there a likelihood that the child would experience long-term suffering and pain if they were provided this treatment? And so you have one aspect of this decision is what is in the best interest of the child.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you have this competing issue of, well, what should we be investing in as a society, given that we have a wide range of competing issues? And so,
but why don't we discuss these standards? I mean, this seems to be under the...
Well, we do discuss
the dark of night, but we don't discuss them very openly at all. You know, whether it's in Congress, whether it's in the state legislatures, whether it's in city meetings of any kind, this you only come across this when you have a situation in your own life that brings you to this brink of these horrible decisions. You know,
we don't discuss these. We don't discuss death very well. We don't discuss end-of-life decision-making for individuals very well. I mean, I've been in the business now for 20 years, and I don't know that I would say, I don't know how much progress there has been. Certainly, states are more now. A little bit. States more readily recognize living wills and those documents and advanced directives to allow patients to express their end-of-life decisions. How often those get respected and actual case-by-case decisions is still, I think, a good bit controversial. But we are just not a country that is comfortable discussing these things. And there is one sense in which we don't like the idea of thinking of life in terms of dollars and cents, and that there is a life here, and that we are making determinations about discontinuing treatment in part either because it's not in the child's best interest or because of the expense associated with it, and those money should be used for other things.
Money is never part of the conversation.
And that's,
you don't want it to be.
You don't, and you say life is something that's intrinsically valuable, and so there's no dollar amount that you can put on it. On the other hand, there are dollar amounts that you can put on it, and actuaries can give you what the value of a life is in any given at any given time.
And
so it's deeply financial, and we don't want to recognize that. We want to say it's deeply immoral to talk about it, and it's not. It's just a reality, and we need to be able to move past
it. Let me get our listeners involved here. Should courts, should hospitals, should doctors have the power to end your child's life? Is there a dollar amount that can be applied to a newborn baby's life in the situation that we're talking about here with the Charlie Gard case over in England? 816-235-2888 is the phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So who is the ultimate authority, Clancy? I'm still looking, who decides?
Well, it varies, of course, from country to country. One thing we don't want to be naive about is the notion that we aren't already always assigning dollar amounts to lives. When it comes to questions other than healthcare, when it comes to the question of hunger and hunger around the world, we're assigning dollars to lives. When it comes to the question of immigration and poverty south of the border, our own border, we're assigning dollars to lives. I mean, we're constantly evaluating how much money are we willing to spend in order to save a human life, very often the lives of children, the lives of infants. Now, we get particularly excited about this, of course,
mm-hmm. as we should,
when we see that the medical resources, that medical technology is sufficient to prevent the loss of life, particularly in the case of an infant or child. You're quite right. We feel like somehow or other, we have a gut reaction that we do not want to assign a dollar sign to the life of an infant or of a child. And surely that's a good thing. But unfortunately, especially as medical technology advances and becomes more and more expensive, we're going to be confronting these decisions. We're confronting them much more now than we were 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we were confronting them dramatically more than we were 30 years ago, mm-hmm. because we simply have, with these advances in medical technology, we have the ability to prolong lives that in the past would not have been prolonged. The technology was not available, and it is very, very expensive technology, mm-hmm. and we don't have unlimited resources.
So how should we as a society be tackling this question then in terms of communicating to people about advances in technology, the cost of those things, and hey, when the rubber hits the road in your family's life at some point, there might be some tough decisions to be made here.
Yeah, there are, in fact, ethics boards in hospitals that help families to navigate this territory and think about these decisions. What we don't have enough of in our own society here in America is regulatory oversight over the practices of insurance companies and how insurance companies are relating to these allocation of resources. And that is a conversation we need to be having at the national level.
Why does that happen?
It gets a lot easier in a single payer system because...
Why isn't the conversation with the insurance companies happening? Because they're sort of outside the system in a sense and operating in their own little orbit with their own financial constraints, and everyone recognizes they have to make a certain profit to keep going?
I think it's not necessarily so much motivated by our recognition of their need for profitability as it is by their own lobbying concerns to maintain their profits and the fact that it's extremely difficult to muster the political will to get any kind of comprehensive agreement on what counts as adequate care, sufficient care. So, you know, after gargantuan efforts by several administrations, we finally got the Affordable Care Act in place, which guaranteed certain kinds of things related directly to what we're talking about, such as not denying pre-existing conditions. Well, already that is, you know, how long have we had the Affordable Care Act? A few years. Mm-hmm. And already it's back on the chopping block because of the power of insurance companies and their lobbying.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Mike from South Kansas City. Mike, good morning.
Oh, I'm not really addressing necessarily the whether it's the parent decision or the insurance company's decision.
Right.
You know, in the situation you're talking about, ideally the parent should, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, should have, and especially in this case, when they have their own cash. But here's my point. I think it's we're talking about spending in too much money and things like that, or you know, you've got to spend it. Let me say wisely. And here's my point. One thing I don't like is keeping old people alive. Having them spend $1 million in their last week fight something that they're gonna die and
right.
And so, anyways, I'll leave it at that.
No, Mike, I appreciate that, and it sort of raises this question, Wayne: are the ethical standards for people at the end of their lives different somehow than for people at the beginning of their lives? Or is it sort of the same issue?
I think that they are a continuum of issues from birth to death and the challenges. And certainly it is the case that the vast majority of money that an individual will spend is generally spent in the last years of their lives. And especially for people with chronic conditions and medical conditions that will keep them in the hospital. And so there has been for decades conversation about really what the goal and purpose and function of a healthcare system should be. Should it be to eke out every ounce of life that you can, keep someone alive as long as possible? Should it be to ensure that people have an average healthy lifespan, and so once you get into the later years of life, the goal or purpose of medicine should shift. It shouldn't be to keep you alive as long as you possibly can, but it should be to ensure that you have a comfortable, you've achieved a normal lifespan, and now we're trying to keep you comfortable and safe and happy.
And my question, have we evolved on that standard over the years? Are we, in your view, in a better place today when it comes to those decisions?
The concept of futility, you might explain, too.
Yeah, I think we are in a better place. I think
more people doing living wills.
Living wills, yeah. Hospice care, palliative care teams that are available in hospitals. And when my own father died last year, similarly, the team coming in and really, you know, talking about, well, these are the different things that we could do, and this is why we would advise not to do those things. And then the palliative care physician would coming in and talking about what the options sort of were. And so I think those conversations are much more prevalent, and hospitals and have staff on people on staff to address those, and we have certainly enhanced that ability. But that doesn't, and I can tell you from a personal perspective, for someone who's talked about end-of-life issues, when you are in that phase as an individual, all that other is kind of, it's, you know, you really are focused on the individuality. And I think that ultimately comes back to one of the challenges in a healthcare system is that, and you ask, how do we move the conversation forward? We are still very much in most of the national debate about the preservation of healthcare systems is keeping individual choice. Choose your own doctor. Do your own thing. This is you, 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 you. We don't talk about healthcare as a global entity.
Not at
as
all.
Yeah. Us, as recognition of the healthcare industry should be there to advance the cause of the nation. I mean, I really see that it's a public and national security issue, if you want to think about it that way, is that protecting the health of the nation is as important as the military is in protecting the borders. If you have a sick country, a sick people, you're going to be more vulnerable financially and otherwise to stresses and strains externally. And so investing in this in the same way that we sort of do in the military, we see that as
right.
As a common good, to see healthcare, insurance, healthcare system as a common good, and to recognize that, you know, individuals' choices may be limited in that system, but the system is there to promote the common good of the people.
And you're saying other countries are doing a better job of that than we are?
I think they are. I mean, England and the U.S.
Statistically,
and Canada
they're doing a much better job.
I mean, the life expectancy in Canada and in the U.K. is much better than it is in the United States. The life expectancy in almost every industrialized world in the world is better than it is in the United
Despite
States.
Despite the fact that we have the most expensive healthcare
yes,
system
exactly.
in the world.
Well, we have a tweet here from Anne who sends us this thought. An another way to ask all this, do parents have the right to prolong the suffering of a dying child for their own peace of mind, Clancy?
Well, legally, very often, yes, they do. Not without exception, but very often they do. Now, morally, these are incredibly tough decisions for parents to make. And
because there's guilt association with it that might be hanging on your backside for years to come.
And this is where actually health professionals and sometimes trained ethicists in health professional settings can be very helpful to parents, where they will go. And I was mentioning earlier this concept we talk about a lot, and when we're teaching this subject to our students, the concept of futility. The notion of futility in healthcare is that when you cannot
utility
expect
or futility?
Futility with
futility.
An F. Mm-hmm. When care is futile because there's not a realistic expectation of recovery. In various end of life settings, or we can only expect that day after day things are going to get worse, pain is going to increase. In these kinds of contexts, yes, I think it's very helpful for someone who is going through what must be an incredibly painful conversation with other healthcare professionals, talking about the death of your child. I can't imagine anything more painful mm-hmm. than that.
Mm-hmm. And this one of the distinctions we do make, and the listeners who I'd be interested in thinking about, is the difference between what we call qualitative and quantitative futility. And so to your question, does a parent have a right to come in and demand something that is quantitatively futile? That is, I want you to do X, and the physician knows that X is not going to be effective mm-hmm. or successful. Physicians don't have to do things because it would be malpractice to do something to a child that you know is medically futile, that it's not going to work. It may actually expose the child to more pain. The issue becomes more complicated when it's qualitatively futile. That is, well, keeping this child alive and on the machines that he is on will certainly keep him alive, but we're talking about the quality of life that
yeah.
person is experiencing. And this is where, even in the United States, this can sometimes, if parents are demanding certain things and the physicians don't feel that it's in the best child's best interest, then we have to go to the courts and we have to get guardians appointed, a guardian ad litem, who can come in and represent the child's interest, which may be contrary to what the parents want.
Gents, let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to shift topics dramatically. We're going to turn to the ethics of loyalty and President Trump's apparent demand of loyalty from former FBI Director James Comey. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR.
Kansas City's own Big Joe Turner pioneered the fusion of R&B with Boogie Woogie. His signature Jump Blues helped put KC on the map. Coming up on the Best of Cypress Avenue, we'll spend an hour with Joe Turner this evening at 7 on KCUR 89.3. It is 69 degrees in Midtown, cloudy right now. We expect some showers and thunderstorms mainly afternoon today with a high of 75. There is a flash flood watch in effect as well, with heavy rains possible tonight with a low of 61 degrees, and Saturday a chance of thunderstorms with a high near 67. KCUR is supported by University Health, downtown's only outpatient surgical center, offering 12 specialty clinics, diagnostic imaging, and a pharmacy. Details about their personal health guide are online at universityhealthkc.org/business. And Kansas City Zoo inviting you to Jazzoo, an evening of peacocks and plumage with food from more than 75 restaurants, specialty bars, and 4 stages of live music and dancing, Friday, June 2nd. Tickets are online at jazookc.org. Let's return now to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3, a service of the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we examined the streetcar expansion ballot and learned why vacant spaces in downtown Kansas City, Missouri, are getting a whole lot harder to find. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate and also on the NPR One app. On Monday, how algorithms and data shape your digital life. Also, some advice for those looking to get into education reform. That's Monday on the show. Well, this hour, we're talking with our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught, Clancy Martin, about some red-hot issues. Here's one other one. Let's turn to the ethics of loyalty, gentlemen. President Trump apparently made a request of loyalty from former FBI Director James Comey. I can imagine very quickly, whether we're talking about this instance or many others, that the topic of loyalty is a hot one in ethics circles, Clancy?
It is. Josiah Royce, the great American philosopher who wrote a book on loyalty.
Josiah Royce,
one of our great American philosophers. He said loyalty is among the most important and among the most fraught of virtues.
Because
if we take loyalty as a kind of a virtue independent of other virtues, it can get us into trouble. We all know it's very important. We treasure the loyalty of our families. We treasure the loyalty of our friends.
But it can be misplaced, is your point.
It can be misplaced. Also, it can get you into trouble even when it is appropriately placed. And what Royce pointed out, and I think that this is something in a way that Comey was appealing to when he was talking to Trump, is that we really, in order for loyalty to work well, we need a hierarchy of loyalties. So at the top of that hierarchy might be something like loyalty to the truth, let's say, or loyalty to the good. And then nested within that is a more refined loyalty and a more refined loyalty, so that we might get down to a place where we said, yes, I am loyal to the president, but I have several higher loyalties that are more important to me, and I will only be loyal to the president insofar as I am not violating some higher order loyalty that is more important.
Which of the great philosophers also talked about loyalty beyond this gentleman you're mentioning? Are there others who weighed in here?
It's a popular virtue among philosophers. I think the first philosopher who is talking about the relationship between loyalty and virtue is Aristotle in the Western tradition. There is also a robust discussion of loyalty in the Eastern tradition, both coming out of Buddhism and out of Confucianism. It's particularly important in Confucianism.
And at UMKC, has Wayne Vaught demanded a pledge of loyalty from you going forward? How does this work within the Arts and Sciences Department?
It was, it was maybe the single most important thing. We all had to sign these little contracts when he took over as dean.
Now he's fealty. Lying. Yeah. Lying is also an unvirtuous thing.
Unfortunately, a loyalty among faculty not only seems hard to come by, but perhaps a contradiction in terms.
Yeah. Well, the president here, Wayne, appoints the FBI director for a 10-year term. That's a given. Mm-hmm. Given that, why is there anything amiss if the president then turns around and seeks loyalty from the head of the FBI? That only seems like logical, and at least on one level.
Well, I think that it's problematic, and it is that loyalty, again, I think, is what we're asking the head of the FBI or any government agent to do, which their first obligation, and I think it fits into exactly what Clancy was saying, is to be loyal to the Constitution mm-hmm. of the United States. That is their fundamental.
That's a different thing than being loyal to the president sometimes.
Right, and yeah. So I don't think that a president rightfully in that situation should ask for personal loyalty. I think what the president should be asking for is professionalism, that you will perform your duties as prescribed and consistent with the laws of the country and the things that the president himself has taken an oath of office to uphold. So anything that he would say subsequent to anyone that he appoints, I think, would have to be coming out of his oath of office in recognition that he's upholding the Constitution of the United mm-hmm. States in so doing.
No matter where that loyalty might lead you is sort of what the message ought to be.
Right. I think mm-hmm. he could say he should be loyal to the United States. He should be loyal to the office. He should be loyal to the people that he represents. But if it's a loyalty that's asking for personal bias, and I think this is where we get into where loyalty can become troublesome, because loyalty is a commitment of a certain bias and preference and priority. Mm. And when one does that, you can start to become blinded to the issues that would potentially question or put you in a situation where you should question your behaviors towards someone. So
that's exactly what James Comey appears to have done here, based on my reading of the New York Times last night, where Trump was sort of playing Comey, working him personally, perhaps to develop a sense of loyalty that, based on what Wayne is just saying here, Clancy, might have been misplaced.
Yeah, there's a great talk given by C.S. Lewis, the Oxford philosopher and popular writer, called The Inner Ring. And he gave it to a graduating class at Oxford. And he said, at some point in your life, someone is going to come to you, speaking to this graduating class at Oxford, and they're going to ask you, are you willing to pledge your affinity, your loyalty to us in order to become part of what he called the inner ring? Mm-hmm. And the inner ring as a very dangerous notion, because he said at that point you have to look at yourself and ask yourself, what matters most to me, my principles or being in the club? And that's very much how I see Trump's request to Comey. Are you willing to join my club? Are you willing to, if necessary, compromise your integrity in order to be one of us, to be with me? And Comey stood the test. I have to hand it to him. I didn't know I'd ever say something publicly nice about James Comey, but he really proved that he's a man of principle, at least in that instance.
Well, this test at C.S. Lewis that you just outlined so well, Clancy, that could apply to the company you work for. It could apply to the fraternity or sorority you choose to join. It could apply to a whole lot of things.
Absolutely. I think most of us who are adults, the reason that you might respond to this notion of the inner ring is most of us have faced that test at one time or another and asked ourselves, wait a second, I'm making a decision now between being liked or being popular or being in the club versus what I know to be right. And it can be a tough test to pass, I think.
I think this loyalty thing can get complicated pretty quickly, Wayne. What about a case involving WikiLeaks, for instance, where someone leaks government secrets to WikiLeaks that the leaker believes are in the national interest, even though the act of leaking is some sort of violation of federal law that they vowed to uphold? I mean, this can get tangled really fast here.
Well, absolutely, it can. And so there you have a public interest that if someone is seen as their priority over protecting a particular law. Certainly, it could get into a kind of a different sort of case. Imagine an employee with a company who has access to, you know, records or secrets or intellectual property of a company and goes somewhere else where there's needs to be a loyalty to that company not to disseminate information that he or she might have, even if it could be beneficial to another company or himself or a nation, that there are certain legal restrictions that protect intellectual property in that case. And when you are a part of that company, you should have loyalty to that company for, I guess, that reason. Here, it's a little different because, you know, I guess the WikiLeaks people are saying that maybe their primary loyalty is to the people or the principles of democracy or whatever it might be, and that when they have documents that demonstrate that there is a subversion of that of that democracy, that they're wanting to get those out and into the public. But it's a very dangerous precedent to set. It opens up for certainly a lot of abuse, and I don't think someone can just under the guise of I'm doing this in the public interest violate laws without certain repercussions coming to them. And this issue of civil disobedience is something that we have seen and has certainly been discussed by philosophers throughout history. And sometimes it leads to really good causes, and we have to justify, well, how do you justify breaking the law in a situation where it actually leads to what you deem to be a very good public outcome.
You know, Clancy, a few minutes ago you said you never thought you'd say something nice about James Comey, and I gather you were referring to his decision before the election to announce to the world that the FBI had reopened a case into Hillary Clinton. And my question is, even then, you know, not an easy decision for anyone to have made. I would not have wanted to be in his shoes. What did you make of that decision? I mean, you clearly didn't like it.
No, I didn't like it. And I think it was not a prudent decision, not a sensible decision, not even a decision kind of within the purview of his professional ethics, the way his job was described. And it is directly relevant to this conversation because one of the reasons loyalty is important is it recognizes, it respects a kind of humility in the face of what we know, what we think we know, mm-hmm. and what we can rely upon. And what I mean is this. Think about your loyalty to your profession, your loyalty to your job, or your loyalty to a friend. Now, sometimes you might say, find your loyalty to a friend tested because you find out something, your friend has done something scandalous right. or has betrayed a different friend, something like that. Now, the reason loyalty could be very important in that context is you recognize that you may not have all the facts yet. You may not know all the information. You take a kind of principle of what we would call epistemological humility, which is just a way of saying you are cognizant of the fact that you don't maybe know as much as you need to know in mm-hmm. order to make an informed decision. But here's one thing you do know. Your friend has always been a good friend.
Right.
In the past, when you've been loyal to your friend, it's been well justified,
right.
and your friend has also been loyal to you. So this is one of the reasons that Royce, for example, says we should be very, very careful in deciding to what and to whom we should be loyal. Then we should evaluate our loyalty and recognize that when our loyalty is tested, then we can rely upon our loyalty, bearing in mind a kind of humility in terms of our ability to understand the larger situation at mm-hmm. hand. And this, for me, in the Comey situation, he sort of failed in terms of loyalty, loyalty to his profession, loyalty to the limits of what he understood, maybe even loyalty to the Constitution at some level when he
right.
when he revealed this information inappropriately about Hillary Clinton and that investigation, but then passed the test and maybe learned something in the interim time when he was asked by Trump for his loyalty, because he recognized this is not a person who has earned my loyalty yet. And this is another important thing we should point out, is loyalty tends to be something that is earned over time, mm-hmm. like respect. Mm-hmm. You can't demand respect. You can't send out a memo to your staff saying, now I want respect. Similarly with loyalty, it has to be earned. It can't merely be demanded.
Well, here's a situation I found myself in several decades ago. Let me just preface this story with that. I'm in Westport on a Saturday night and with some good friends. A very good friend of mine gets into a tussle with some other guy over a woman or something, and things begin to escalate very quickly, and fists are being thrown. Well, without really knowing what had caused the fight, I went to the aid of my friend, just rushed right in, not knowing anything, and found myself getting tossed out of a bar for the only time in my life, rather dramatically. But I didn't know what the fight was about. I didn't know who was right and who was wrong, but out of loyalty for my friend, I dove right in there.
It's a perfect example. It's a perfect example of why loyalty can be dangerous at times, but in this circumstance, I would argue that you did the morally appropriate thing.
Given I passed the test. There you go. 30 years later, I can say I passed the test.
And you passed the test of epistemological humility too. You didn't know exactly what the situation was, but you knew your friend needed help, and you're a good friend.
Let's go to a call here. Florence from Kansas City, Kansas is back with us. Florence, good morning.
Good morning, Steve and guests. A quick question that I tried to form quickly. Of the present rules of conduct we are witnessing in the hierarchies of our government, of we the people, what elements of erosion of this ethical rules of conduct produce this toxic climate that seems to be threatening our cherished moral concepts of freedom, justice, and equality for all?
Florence, thank you. What erosion of ethics are we seeing out in the country right now that might lead to this current political climate that we're experiencing right now? Are you seeing an erosion out there? Or does that go without saying?
Well, yes, I think it's a little bit difficult to argue that there is not erosion, moral erosion at the very highest levels of our government right now. We have seemed to have become completely oblivious to the importance of truth mm-hmm. for the arguably the most powerful person in the world. If Clinton had told one of the lies in the course of his presidency that our current president seems to tell almost every day, he would have been called to task for it in a different way than our current president is being called to task. So, yes, clearly there's some erosion. The causes of the erosion, well, I am optimistic that as a people, we can learn from our mistakes, and that we will recognize, hey, a lot more of us should have turned out and voted than did, and next time around, we won't be quite as careless with the political process as we were last time, because I don't feel like the moral fabric of the nation is necessarily eroding. I'd like to believe not, but there is evidence that at the top level right now, yes, rampant erosion of...
Are you seeing an erosion of ethics just broadly speaking across the country, Wayne, or is that just too big of a bite of the apple to even ask here?
An erosion of ethics?
Yeah, or just sort of ethical behavior as you watch the country sort of move forward here.
There's an evolution of ethical behavior. Whether it's an erosion is an assessment of whether that change is good or bad. Obviously, I think that there are, you know, probably cases where there's indifference to a lot of things, and there are people who are justifying doing things that we in the past would not have been as readily willing or able to agree that those were proper behaviors. But it's kind of difficult for me to assess. I think there are a lot of good people out there. I interact with them and want to see good causes and are responding in ethically charged ways. And in some sense, maybe this will lead to a resurgence of real moral concern. And in some ways, I think there's probably a strengthening of morality. We're just sort of seeing out on the stage these examples of really immoral behavior.
Let me end on a humdinger here today. United Airlines. No one thinks it was right to drag that passenger off the plane last month. Here's my question to you, Clancy. Is it ethical for airlines to overbook intentionally its flights, especially when it knows it will need to transport flight crews on some of these flights, as what happened in this case, apparently? You're overbooking. People are expecting to take a flight. What about that?
Well, it is never morally appropriate to make a contract with a person which you do not intend to fulfill. It's just
my point.
Yeah, it's always morally inappropriate to make a promise that you're intending to break. It's not only inappropriate, it's rationally contradictory. It's kind of a crazy thing to do. This is what Immanuel Kant pointed out back in the 18th century, that when we...
Good old Kant.
Yeah. That when we make a promise intending to break it, it's not a promise anymore. It's just a lie. And so no one would, I think, go around saying that universal lying by air companies is a morally appropriate thing. So no, it's clearly morally inappropriate. It's probably also legally inappropriate.
But the president of United Airlines, if he was sitting here with us, he or she, I don't know who it is, would say, hey, we know that so many people aren't going to show up for a certain flight, and we got seats to fill, and people want to fly, and that's how it goes.
Well, evidently
and it's
not.
In the contract, right? I mean, it's in your ticket.
It's in your ticket.
Says that you're buying this
that
ticket
no one reads.
With the understanding that you may not actually get anywhere. And so we accept this because at least to the degree that they are not being regulated on these facts, they're able to do it. And I think air travel has become increasingly worrisome in this regard. But the particular case was also difficult because there were other ways in which the airline could have handled that situation and gotten everywhere where they needed to be without doing what they did. And so that was clearly an egregious overstep of what the airline industry needed to do. And you can understand them, and it's sort of an issue that I, as dean, am dealing with here in terms of how many courses do we offer and maximizing the number of students in each of the seats and making sure that we're not profitable, but we're basically not losing money. And so the airline industry is certainly concerned about doing that as well and maximizing. And I haven't been in a flight recently, I don't know about you, that wasn't almost completely full.
Yeah.
So they need to do that. But I think that they're doing it in such a way that it's causing harm, and there needs to be clear regulation to prevent them from doing that.
We're going to leave our conversation right there with our good ethics professors, Wayne Vaught, the dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences, Clancy Martin, a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC. Gents, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
It was always great. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
You can download our podcast and listen to previous programs. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. And you can follow me at Steve Kraske. On Monday, how algorithms affect our digital lives and advice on education reform.
The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Denny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.